right, might as well get started. Thank you very much for coming to my session. If you don't want to know about storage options in Windows Azure, then you're in the wrong session. Okay. So today I'm going to be talking about, you know, I guess trying to make it less confusing the multitude of options you have for storing data inside Windows Azure and how to actually get to it, how to use it, and how to decide what the best option is when you're setting up your application. So who am I? I'm an architect, IT consultant at Object Consulting, the country partner of the year this year, which is always nice. I've been working with Azure since it went live many years ago now. And I guess most critically, I've actually delivered a lot of large Azure projects, you know, on the Azure platform, some of them hybrids, some of them 100% in Azure. So we're talking about, you know, I've solved these problems in the real world. And I'm old and grey. Feel that way anyway. I've been sick. You probably noticed my voice. I've been sick for the last 2 weeks now. Hope my voice will cope. All right. So the goal of this presentation is to give you the tools to make the decisions for yourself. I can't make the decisions for you as to what the best storage option is, but hopefully after this you'll be a little bit better placed to make that choice for yourself. Just a quick rundown. So we're going to be talking about, to start with, we're actually going to talk about features of storage in general, okay? I don't know necessarily what level everybody's at, so hopefully that'll give everyone some ideas about the sort of things you should be looking at. Then we're going to review the main storage technologies on Windows Azure. Have a bit of a talk about performance. Not a huge discussion, but you know, a little bit of stuff on performance for the major choices that people have. A little bit of chat about processing cloud scale data, although I'm really going to leave that for another session, which is on Friday, which I'll get to later on. Anyway, stuff. So that's what we're talking about. All right, so features of any sort of storage option, right? And this doesn't apply just to the cloud, but you need to understand these things before you... you need to understand this before we can really sort of proceed into looking at the different options that we have. Okay, so let's start with organization. What does that mean? Organization is how the data internally to the storage system is organized. Okay, so you know, a file system, for example, would generally be considered to be an unstructured data storage because you're just chucking blocks of data on there, unless you're on an AS400 or something. Whereas a relational database, we understand things like that, SQL Server and so on. So I guess you need to understand what the native way that your data is being stored. Then you've got lifecycle, okay? Some of the storage options that we were talking about are relatively permanent. In other words, you know, you put something there, and you come back in, you know, a week or two, it'll still be there until you delete it. Whereas other ones are transient. They're very much just going to last for, you know, days, hours, minutes, depending on what you've actually asked for. You know, why would you want a storage system that doesn't store stuff forever? Well, you know, we'll get into that. How do you program it? Okay, and this is important because you know your development team. Okay, you know what the skills of your development team are, and that's one of the key things you need to think about when you're actually choosing a storage option. You know, it doesn't matter if you pick the most amazing storage option in the world, if your development team isn't up to really understanding that and delivering what you need to deliver in the time that you have allowed, then it's not a good choice. So, do you have an open protocol? Something like a web service, for example. Or a proprietary protocol, like SQL Server, for example, has got a proprietary protocol, there's no web services there. Are there language APIs for the language that you want to develop in to make life easier? Or are you going to have to program directly against some sort of, you know, network-type service? And then another one about how data is organized within the store. Can you access data effectively randomly? Can you get to data anywhere in the store? Or is it a sequential sort of mechanism? You know, queues and stacks and whatnot. The funny thing about so many of these questions, it feels like we've come back around to where we were in the 90s and the late 80s. So then we're talking about things that, you know, for so many years, all the way through the 2000s, it was always SQL databases and relational databases, but suddenly we're talking about other things, and the questions that are coming up are basically the same as we had when we were talking about files on a mainframe or on a desktop machine. Anyway, scalability. So how scalable is it? Can you scale it to support millions and millions of users or not? Now, that might not be important for you. So once again, it's something you have to consider when you're choosing a storage option. How easy is it to actually implement your scalability? You know, do you have to, you know, be some sort of whiz at, you know, the particular technology you're talking about? Or can it just be, use it this way and it'll do your scaling fine? And of course, you know, does it scale only horizontally or vertically? And we'll, horizontal scaling, of course, being adding machines, and vertical scaling being making the machines bigger that the storage is on. And, you know, how's the performance characteristics? Does it fit your expected workload? And that's important as well. If your expected workload is going to be, you know, a small number of ACID transactions that have to be, you know, done in a particular way, you're not going to pick something that doesn't support broad transactions. If you're going to be expecting to support, you know, a billion accesses every hour, you're not going to pick something that can't handle that. Might sound obvious, but the number of times I've seen projects start without considering these things and they get halfway through and go, you know what? We probably should have checked that. Cost. Now, Azure has turned the cost algorithm sort of on its head in a lot of respects. Back in the day, you know, before cloud solutions, you know, you kind of didn't, as a developer, you didn't think about, or an architect even, you didn't really think about cost that much. Because you weren't building out the hardware or whatever, you didn't really care. And whatever the hardware they're going to put it on, it was going to be big enough for your machine, for your application, and you'd hope for the best. These days, the decisions that you make at a development and an architectural level have a direct impact on the bottom line if you're coding against most of the Azure storage options. You know, how many transactions you put against your storage system. Who cares about that sort of thing, right? Well, no, that can actually kill you in terms of cost if you get it wrong. Yeah, and there are other things to consider, you know, schema management, transaction support, management and monitoring. So you need to consider all of these things as you're going through. Oh, yeah, and of course, any limitations, you know, in the way that stuff is stored, how big it can get, what it does under load. Now, that's another thing that's very critical, and we'll talk about that through the presentation. How does the storage mechanism behave if you load it down? Does it just keep on trucking, or does it reach some tipping point and just stop working? So we'll start with the obvious one, right? SQL Azure. Everyone loves relational databases. At least we did for the last, you know, 25 years. So categorizing it against, and this is what we're talking about, the features previously, right? Categorizing SQL Azure against those features. So obviously, it's relational. It's permanent, proprietary protocol, very mature API support, and also very mature, I guess, community. Everybody knows how to program against SQL Azure. A lot of the performance things, you know, how to tune a SQL database, everyone knows how to do that, right? We've been doing it for many, many, many years. Random access, good scalability, not fantastic, right? And we'll get to that in a minute. And the horizontal and vertical scaling in Azure is both, they're both manual, right? There's no automated help there. Okay, you pick a size, or you pick a structure for your SQL databases, and that's stuck until you change it. And this is charged per instance. as in, I have one database, I'm charged X dollars a month for it. So it's just like real, you know, SQL Server on the premise, right? Not quite. There are differences. And the gap has been shrinking over the years. Back when SQL Azure was first released, there were no support for a lot of the geometry and geographical sort of GIS functions in SQL Azure. Now it looks like they're in there. So, you know, any of these things that we talk about today, you know, if you do have a sort of edge case, check again, because it might be coming out, you know, next week, or it might be coming out next month. The threshold, yeah. Behavior under load can be a little bit nasty. We're used to SQL Server on the on-premise, right? You hit it too hard, yeah, your queries start taking a long time to run, and the CPU gets hammered on the SQL Server, whatever. But it typically will still return your record sets to you. Not so in SQL Azure. It'll just start rejecting your transactions. So you need to make sure that you've got a good solid. And look, this actually is important for anything in the cloud, but you need to make sure you have a very solid retry policy in your code. Now, I'm going to spruik someone else's session here. There's a session, Wade Wegner's got a session on Friday about planning for failure. So it would be well worth, if you're planning to actually build decent-sized applications in the cloud, probably be worth attending that one. I'll have the details of that up later. Of course, your backups don't work the same way as they do in local SQL, so if you're used to, you know, taking a backup of your database and, you know, on your disk and playing around with it and loading it up again, you can't quite do that anymore because you don't have access to the SQL Server. And as I said, the feature set's not identical. Table storage. Okay, so Azure Table Storage, or whatever they call it these days here, Windows Azure Table Storage, I still haven't renamed that one, is a bit of a tricky one. I've found that most developers who are used to relational databases take a long time to get their head around the way that it works. But as we'll sort of, I'll discuss during this presentation, it's well worth doing. Okay, so we've all, probably most of us have heard about the sort of NoSQL movement, i.e., you know, databases that aren't relational. Once again, we're going back to the old mini computer days, really, but you know, with a modern twist, I suppose. So table storage is not the most brilliant NoSQL store in the universe, but it is very functional, and I've used it in quite large systems under heavy load, and it works well, fast, as long as you understand how to design data for it. So it's a structured data store. So it's not relational. There's no relationships between records and that sort of stuff. There's no doing joins and all these sorts of things. Where you have a number of keys and then a number of columns worth of data. The data itself is flat. So it's almost like an indexable CSV file, if you were. Permanent, obviously. You put something in it, you can expect to get it out again at any time. It's only got a web service API, but then it's got managed APIs around that. Very good ones for .NET. Pretty much all the major platforms now, Java and JavaScript, Python. Random access, you can get to a record anywhere you are, anywhere in the store immediately. Scaling. You control the scaling with table storage, and it's very, very easy. So you decide how you want your data to be arranged. So if it's going to be, you know, all in one place so you can get it really, really easily, so because you only got a small amount of data, or spread out over the entire storage fabric. But it's under your control. And it's also got, to a certain extent, it's got automatic vertical scaling, although it's very hard to demonstrate that, and it keeps changing. But basically, if, you know, a particular set of data is getting hit very hard, there's a good chance it'll get moved onto hardware that'll give you your results quicker. And you charge based on both how big and how much you hit. So it's a very different model from the way SQL Server is. So if you provision yourself for table storage and then don't use any storage, you won't pay anything. unlike SQL Server, whereas well, as soon as it's there, it's being charged at, you know, X dollars a month. Ugh. Okay, so the only problem is that if you're used to dealing with SQL stores where you can index stuff and, you know, cut your data, you know, 45 different ways, it might seem a little bit limiting. Because the only things that identify where your record is table name, what they call a primary key. Oh, a primary key. What do I say primary key? That's stupid. It's a partition key. Well, doesn't matter how many times you read something, it'll be wrong. Partition key, sorry, and row keys. So effectively, things within a given partition will tend to cluster on the same machines. So if partition key is, say, X, and you have, you know, row keys varying, they'll tend to stay together. Whereas if you vary your partition key, they will move around. So this is this horizontal scaling that I was talking about before. If you choose your partition keys appropriately, you can have your load distribute over the entire storage fabric that Azure uses. But there are no secondary indexes. So the most efficient way to get something out of table storage is with that partition key and the row key and the table name. That will give you a record instantly, one record, bang. If you want to, for example, get it out by something that's in the actual data itself, forget about it, because it's not never going to work performance-wise. So this is what I said, you have to understand how the data is arranged to be able to use it, and it is difficult for people who've come from a SQL background. So each record is about 1 megabyte. So, you know, a given entry in table storage is about 1 megabyte with 200 and something odd columns, 64K. So, you know, it's... And the columns are all named and it's in a sort of atom format. But the main thing is that it's effectively a flat, you know, structure within, you know, with named columns. Typed columns, though, obviously. So we've got... It supports columns of, you know, byte arrays, booleans, date times, doubles, GUIDs, you know, various ints and strings. You know, there are ways around this, and that's one of the things you're going to have to come up with if you're going to use table storage, is how do you map your domain model into table storage in an effective way? So it's a lot more difficult. And there are ways around it. For example, there are packages out there that will kind of just serialize your entire thing and shove it in a table row as a zipped up record. It's a bit cheating. You lose some of the flexibility of table storage. Yeah, so data modeling. Sorry, not easy. Blobs. Okay. You know, if you're going to go the route of, as I was talking about before, just serializing an object and shoving it into table storage, why not just shove it in a blob instead? So blobs are one of the other major storage fabric things from Azure. So they're completely unstructured storage. So, you know, literally just a bunch of data with some metadata attached to it. Permanent random access. Web service API, of course, manage it again. Also, unlike the other ones, you can have a direct access to the content delivery network. So we'll talk about CDNs in a minute. So, you know, it automatically will replicate the stuff from blob storage into the content delivery network. Automatic horizontal and vertical scaling. You know, effectively, it's like table storage where every blob has its own partition and row keys. So it'll just spread out over the storage fabric, and you're not going to overload just one machine. And cost model is the same as table storage. Size and the number of transactions that you're dealing with. Okay, there are two types, though, with blob storage, and they're kind of designed for two different things. So block blobs are really set up for things like images and maybe videos, that sort of stuff. We'll upload a large single thing up into the cloud. You can write them, and they're not particularly easy to update. But they're, you know, they're kind of cheap to work with, and the API is very, very simple. Page blobs are actually what lives behind the Azure virtual machine hard drives, VHDs, they actually use an SMB driver that talks to a page blob. So as you update your hard drive in your VM up in Azure, it's often pushing stuff into a page blob. So obviously performance is going to be pretty good if it can actually work as a file system driver. It's stored in a number of different ways. Queues. Another thing from the Azure Storage Fabric is queues. Now, the queues in Azure aren't necessarily what you'd be used to from something like MSMQ, which is a very high performance queuing mechanism, or MQ series, one of those sort of things. They're a little bit, a little bit softer. They're not designed for supporting distributed asynchronous operations at high speed like you might have in a stock trading system. They're more for distributing workload around. So as long as you understand that and performance test them within your application model, you're going to be okay. Okay, so queues are unstructured again. Basically, you've just got, insert this block of data, insert this block of data in the queue. They're permanent. If you queue something and never pull it off the queue, in theory, it's going to hang around forever. Sequential access, it is a queue after all. Same APIs, basically, as all the storage fabric stuff, web service, managed APIs in all the different languages, and costs based on transaction and the amount of data that you stored in them. And that's actually a really, really important point for a queue. These queues don't have a notification mechanism, right? They don't have something that says, hey, I've got a new thing to give to you. What they have is, poll me. And every polling, of course, is a transaction. So if you're polling too quickly, you're just ramping up your transactions. So you often, you want to be considering that, particularly if you've got a lot of workers trying to suck stuff out of your queue. Maybe don't poll every 10 milliseconds, Can you back off a little bit? But that may sound funny, but if you're used to things like MSMQ, then you might be polling for things every few milliseconds. But it's not really for that. As I said, the performance isn't fantastic on them. Particularly end queuing performance, you can actually only queue one message at a time. So if you're trying to queue up a big workload, you're probably wanting to make messages that are a little bit bigger that say, hey, do this bunch of stuff, maybe queuing batches instead. But you can dequeue up to 32 messages at a time. So it's like it's weighted towards the worker end of things. They used to be only 8K, so what people would do for the larger stuff or for more complicated messages that actually offload into blob storage or whatnot, now they're 64K. Yeah, you're still not going to be queuing up an image for processing, for example. You're going to be queuing up this is something you need to do, it's over there. So don't queue up huge structures into your queue. Prefer to, point at some other storage mechanism, be it in SQL or table storage. Very good support for failure recovery, though. So, I've been dissing the queues a little bit, but one thing they do work really well is if your worker spits the dummy processing something, if you've written your code right, it'll come back in a couple of minutes or whenever you've actually said. So you actually specify, I reckon it's going to take me a couple of minutes to process this. If I haven't said I'm done with that by then, give it back to me again. So, if you have workers go down, which they will, you can be pretty much guaranteeing that you'll pick it up eventually. Of course, that also means that it's not quite FIFO. Remember I said earlier, sequential ordered access FIFO. Not guaranteed, right? Because if you imagine you've spit the dummy, it's not going to block the entire queue. While you make sure that you have actually finished doing that thing. So it's sort of FIFO. So don't try and push things through a queue that absolutely guarantee have to be done in order, because you'll set yourself up for failure big time. Any number of writers and readers. So you can, you know, have 1,000 things writing stuff to the queue and, you know, 1,000 workers reading stuff off the other side of it, no problem at all. And there's a cost based on the transactions, as I said before. Okay, so that's basically the end of the primary main options that are permanent type storage. After this, we start getting into things that aren't permanent, transient storage of various kinds. So the first one of those is cache. Now, Azure Cache was introduced, I don't know what it had been, about a year and a half ago now, something like that. And it started out as a shared type thing. You know, they pushed out a certain number of instances of this thing. And it's very similar to Memcached and things like that. It's a key value store. You know, you give it a key and some string value or, you know, byte blob value, and it'll stick it in there. And then it'll give it back to you later on. The difference is that unlike the other ones, which are stored on disk, the stuff in cache is going to be stored in RAM only and distributed across a number of machines. So it's very, very quick to get it back and fairly consistent as well in the speed that things are going to come back at. You know, web service API, .NET SDK. It's now got the same web service as Memcached. So all those Java programs you've got that use Memcache, you know, you can pretty much just point them at this thing and it's ready to go. When I wrote this originally, you know, I really was thinking that the shared service was where cache was sort of best used. But just recently, they've changed the APIs again. It's in preview now. That you can, on your web roles in Azure, you can say that you want it to be a cache role as well. Okay. So if you're going to put out, I don't know, a 16-node web cluster, you know, they're not going to be 100% utilized all the time. So you can say, okay, put 30, 40% of the RAM, or 50%, whatever you want to do, of every one of those instances and make it a cache instance as well. That means that you get it for free because the charge model for the original shared service cache was, you know, you had between 128 megabytes and 4 gigabytes. That was it of cache storage. And it was expensive, really, really, really expensive. You know, enough that, you know, if you really, really, if you weren't sure if you needed it, you wouldn't even bother. But now that you have it available as a thing that all of your web roles can be cache roles as well, just for you, suddenly it starts to make a lot more sense. And I reckon you should probably always use that once it becomes mainstream. Okay, so they're stored in memory on a distributed cluster of machines. You know, you stick something in, there's no guarantee you're ever going to get it back, because it might get wiped out of the cache, the cache node could go down, something like that. So don't put anything in there that you really care about. But if you've got things that, well, it's a cache, right? So if you've got things that take a while to retrieve, be it from a SQL database or something else, stick them in the cache is a very good idea. Yeah, it also has, because it's based on the old, codename Velocity stuff that Microsoft put out, the at Fabric Azure cache. So it also has a local in-memory copy. Even if you're using remote versions of the data, you can actually have a small area that's local as well. So it's either fast, it's either extremely fast or very fast to get data out of the cache, which is obviously what you want. And this is very important, the distributed notification model. No point putting something in a cache if you've got no way of knowing that it's actually not valid anymore. You know, you just end up with major problems. So the cache server will tell you that that one's not valid anymore. So if you're using local cache, it will actually invalidate it for you, and you can say that's not valid anymore. Get rid of that, and it you know, purges and so on. This one at the bottom, that was more about the shared one, and that was one of the reasons why it looks like the shared version of Azure Cache may well go away, because the limitations on the number of transactions per hour you could put into the cache were quite disturbing. So your app would just perform great because you've built this greatly architected thing and so on. And then suddenly, bang, it just suddenly that stops working because your cache is, and you haven't handled the way that the cache is kicking your connections off. What are we doing for time? No, doing all right. CDN, another transient way of storing data. Not strictly part of Azure platform, but it is very, very closely related, right? So the Microsoft CDN is a geographically distributed cache of files, generally of HTTP type things. And the big names in this are things like Akamai and so on, which most of the bigger websites in the world are using this sort of thing. It's the only way with the Microsoft cloud service that you can deliver content from Australia to your users, okay? Otherwise, you're delivering from the fastest data center from here at the moment, in my testing anyway, is Singapore, Southeast Asia. But Singapore is still a few thousand kilometers away, and your ping times are going to suffer because of the speed of light not being quite what you want it to be. So it really does make a big difference to have to switch the CDN on. And there are it's reasonably simple ways of doing that. So if you are building a website or something which delivers reasonably static content and lots of it, definitely consider the use of it. Either the Microsoft one or Akamai. Shouldn't say that because I might get in trouble. They've got a few more points of presence. They're a more complicated model. The Microsoft CDN is much easier to use. And as I said before, you can directly connect your blob storage to the CDN so that you just tick a box. And then from then on, any blobs, block blobs in particular, that you reference directly out of the blob storage. So when your clients directly go to blob storage to pull up some image, for example, of some mewling kitty or whatever, it will automatically pick their nearest CDN node, mirror it out to there. And it's easy and doesn't require a lot of effort on your part. It's also cheaper to deliver content from the CDN than it is from Azure. So once again, we're coming down to cost, right? And as I said before, minimize how important this cost thing is, okay? Azure is cheap, right? But when you start building really, really big sites, any hosting environment is gonna start getting expensive. So design around the cost model right from the beginning. And if you're delivering from the CDN, it's about half the cost, something like that. Although if you're delivering things that aren't getting hit very often, it's more expensive because you've got to pay to deliver it from Azure into the CDN, and then you've got to pay to deliver it from the CDN. So there's never anything simple, but you need to understand that these things are happening. One of the last things I'm going to talk about in terms of actual storage options is a new one, which actually came from the open source world, which is Hadoop. Is it trademarks? Apache Hadoop. Basically, this is a big Java-based Apache thing that is designed to process huge amounts of data. And Microsoft has sort of picked it as their answer to big data processing. So there's really good tie-ins with SQL Server and this sort of thing. And there is now an option to basically deploy a Hadoop cluster, from the management console. I think it's probably still in preview, but deploy a Hadoop cluster from there. So if you work for a bank or someone that's actually generating a lot of data, scientific, that sort of stuff, and you need to process huge amounts of it really, really quickly. Far greater scale than any reporting services or most BI things that you'd ever deal with. Hadoop is something to look at. There is a presentation on Hadoop on Thursday, I think. I'll put up the details for that later on. I'm going to be going along to it. I think you should, if you're into large data. Okay. Sometimes you think you're very special. Maybe you are special, I don't know. You get to that point where you need something for yourself. And that's when the virtual machine options come in. Particularly now that the whole infrastructure as a service thing has become more mainstream in Azure. You may have, for example, there's nothing that MySQL can do that SQL Azure can't do. Nothing that Memcache can do that you couldn't do with Azure cache. And you could put Oracle on there if you could get the licensing to work. But why would you do this? Okay? The reason is that you're trying to migrate an application, for example, from an on-premise. And you've got one thing, one little component of it. You just can't get away from the fact that it uses this. You don't want to rewrite it, or you can't rewrite it, and maybe it uses MySQL. That's what virtual machines are for, okay? Solve your problem. But if you're building a new application from scratch, don't build virtual machines for your storage. You know, you're going to have to solve all the problems that Microsoft has already solved for you for scalability with SQL or Storage Fabric. Okay, performance. So nothing, it's not worth talking about a storage option that's so slow that you'll never actually use it, right? At the end of the day, we want our data, we want it now, we want it fast, and we want it at the loads that we're talking about. So first thing is, if you're trying to do performance testing on the emulator environment and going, oh my God, it's so horrible, well, that's because it's an emulator environment, it doesn't work. I've seen people do that. I know it's a throwaway comment, but yeah, people get a bit disappointed from that. So you have to do it on real Azure instances. And the platform's constantly changing. There's new versions and so on of it. So just because you read on the internet that something is a bit slow, well, this type of workload doesn't work right, Microsoft's also reading those blog postings, right? The next month there might be a release that fixes that issue. So at the end of the day, I've got some performance testing stuff here. Use it as a guide. Don't trust it if you've got something really critical you need to do. And that said, when you're doing your performance testing, don't just test, oh, look, you can read and write really fast. That might not be what you're doing, right? What is your application going to do? What are the most common operations that your application is going to be performing? That's what you should be testing. Those exact scenarios, because there could be some edge case that makes your choices very, very bad. So if your performance is critical, you have to do your own testing. Sorry. Okay, so I built some testing stuff up for this. Didn't quite get as far as I would have liked because I've been sick for the last 2.5 weeks. Basically, I built a simple Azure application with a web front end, a scalable number of worker roles, and wrote a couple of tests that I could push out across those worker roles. Now, I wasn't trying to stress test the Azure environment, although that said, one of my main runs, I did 10 million reads and 10 million writes in, a couple of minutes. But that's not really stressing the Azure environment. I'm not sure, whether you could. You probably could if you tried, but I'm not sure Microsoft would appreciate it that much. Although they do actually, they don't explicitly forbid it. I don't know if you've worked with Amazon and some of the other cloud providers. They actually explicitly prohibit in their terms of use doing performance testing against their platform. Microsoft doesn't do that. It's mostly confident. So that's not really that appropriate anymore. I wanted to test a range of different things. I ended up mainly doing the small objects batch size sort of thing, which I'll get to right now. We'll do a bit of a quick demo, show how that all came together. How are we doing for time anyway? We are doing, all right, 5 minutes for this. Okay, so, should have pressed F5 first. So, very simple deployment diagram, right? So we've got a front-end web application, and I was using 19 back-end workers so that I could make sure I could stress out my storage options, which we'll just do now. So, look, code. I won't show this for very, very long because, you know, you've seen one piece of code, you've seen them all. But in the intertable storage, I was storing this object here, right? It's got six fields, one of each of the type that they that are supported by the platform, and it's got a partition key and a row key. And for symmetry, I did almost exactly the same thing for SQL Azure as well, including indexing it by partition key and row key, so that, you know, a very, very, very close test. I'll actually show you the most beautiful app in the world. Like I said, I've been sick for the last few weeks, so sue me. Look at this. Isn't it fantastic? Isn't it beautiful? Assuming it hasn't gone to sleep. Wake up. All right. So basically, each of the jobs says how many, produces a number of variables that it can, you know, parameters to actually configure where the job works. Because we're talking about table storage, you know, number of partitions. So this is how many partitions do we spread our writes across. You know, I think actually with the final run, it was 100. How many batches of data am I sending down to every single partition, reading and writing? And I actually was sweeping. I swept across the batch sizes. So I started from a batch size one writing record at a time up to 100. Okay. Now, that's for both reading and writing. So it's not the most realistic model in the universe of load, but it was enough to demonstrate what I was trying to achieve in this case. And SQL, very, very close. So I could actually match the number of things. How many batches we're going to do, batch size start, batch size end. So by setting the number of batches to be the product of the number of partitions and the number of batches per partition, I could get the same amount of load from both tests. And so basically you say, okay, I want to run this thing on 19 workers, and it goes off and runs a test and slams your storage infrastructure quite a bit. So, and then output stuff like this, which, you know, it's like, wow, numbers, yay. Anyway, I'm going to make graphs out of those, which we will look at right now. Where's my thing going here? Okay, look, it's a graph. So I recorded a whole bunch of things, but these are probably the most interesting numbers. So average read and write time and minimum read and write time. So the blue is table storage, the purple is SQL Azure. You know, as is probably normal, you know, reads are generally a bit quicker than writes. You'll notice that with the table storage, the reads were significantly faster than writes. So, you know, both in the minimum and in the average cases. So, you know, that tells you immediately for small batches of data, of reading and writing, that table storage is quite suited to a read-heavy workload, okay, which quite often is what you have, but not always. Once again, you need to shape this to your model. And then I did another test. Well, so I swept from 1 to 100 in the batch size. You'll notice that the Azure SQL average write times went up quite a bit at batches of 20, but they're much quicker than here. You know, here we were talking about what average write time of around the 18 millisecond mark for a single record. When we're writing batches of 20, it's down to 3.5 milliseconds a record, so it's quite good. And read time has improved. In this case, the average read time turned out to be not to scale as well with a large batch for table storage, which is interesting, right? So if you're pulling in larger batches of data, you know, maybe SQL Azure is going to do better for you. Once again, you need to test with your loads. But you'll see, anyway, that these are pretty comparable numbers, right? We're not talking an order of magnitude difference. So performance-wise, these are very similar. So So why wouldn't you just use SQL Azure for everything? Everyone knows relational databases. This is the reason why, okay? I'll get the laser out. These lines here are the load performance for SQL Azure, and these ones are the ones for table storage, okay? Up here, we're reading and writing, you know, hundreds of thousands of, tens or 20,000 records a second, actually more like 100,000 records a second, or more, right? Down here, it's, you know, nowhere near that. SQL Azure got to a load level, I suppose, of about 25 in my test, and then just stopped working, right? I didn't put any retry into my code. I deliberately wanted to demonstrate this. What happens when you hit it too hard? So that means that if you're going to be using SQL Azure, or Windows Azure SQL Server, you need to pay attention to how big your instance is before your application's deployed, or if it's going to be too big for a single instance of SQL Azure, you're going to have to come up with some sort of sharding strategy or some way of spreading the load out of multiple SQL servers, and you probably should anyway, make sure you have an effective caching strategy to reduce that load down to a level where this sort of thing doesn't happen, or is limited. I mean, you're never going to stop it completely, okay? Because the thing is that this behavior isn't just for you. It's actually for, it's often for everybody on that instance of the SQL Server node that is actually being hit. So when I was doing this, there's a pretty good chance that anybody else on that SQL Server node was also experiencing the same problem. So I didn't run it for very long. I was being good. So this is why Wade's session on Friday on planning to fail, or whatever it's called, is worth attending, okay? You need to implement proper retry policies and things like that, far more than you would if you're coding on-premise against a SQL Server. It's just, otherwise you're just setting yourself up for a disaster. Reading for the keyboard. I'm a keyboard person. All right. So what I'd like to talk about now, just briefly, is a few architectural patterns, I suppose, to try to address these inherent performance issues and, I guess, get the most out of the platform. Most of them are pretty obvious. You would have seen them before. But, you know, it's worth revisiting just to sort of hammer home the point that you're not just choosing one storage option, okay? I mean, unless your application is very, very small, in which case, yeah, you probably don't care, right? You have to choose a set of storage options. So what does that mean? For example, let's say we wanted to, this is a tier of a number of different things, tiered by performance. So local cache, that's going to be the quickest of all, right? Azure cache, table storage, relational database. Now, I've built systems that had this model, right? Where there was a huge amount of data in a relational database, and it was really hard to shard it out. So you just knew that if you were trying to hit it directly, it was just going to perform badly, right? But the relational database was that key. That was where everything was. And so because it was so expensive getting stuff out of the relational database, we actually cached sort of pre-processed information into table storage. And then on top of that, that stuff got cached into the local and the Azure cache as well. And that really does, you know, it's architecturally complicated, but if you're programming for pure performance, it's the only way to go, because a single store is never going to be able to answer all your problems. So this is saying, you know, the database was very, very big, and I couldn't do much about it. It was being migrated out of an existing system. We couldn't touch the schema. So this is why we ended up with such a complicated architectural model. And, you know, it turned something from a system which would never have worked into a workable application. If you do it right, it'll work well, and it won't cost you a huge fortune. If you do it badly, you know, you'll get cache miss after cache miss, and you end up running every query against every single tier. So instead of making your system faster, you've made it slower, and you've made it more expensive to run. So you need to test this stuff, right? Performance test it, functional test it, everything, to make sure that it's actually working against the sort of loads that you are expecting. And you need to monitor them so that you know how they are performing in real life once the rubber hits the road, as it were. Problem is, you know, it's architecturally complex. You've got so much stuff to do to make it work right. And you know, you've got stale data and so on. Your dev team's going to hate you, potentially, if this is what your architecture is like, if it doesn't need to be. You know, if you're building Hello World, you don't need to do this. So think about it before you implement these patterns. You might think that's obvious, but sometimes people will build a system for what they expect or they think the load's going to be in 10 years. Not necessarily a good idea. Another common pattern in Azure, that this is using queues, right, is queued updates or queued processing, I suppose, of the data that you're getting. So this is usually a thing to improve business tier scalability, right? So let's say you're using table storage. Now, one of the keys to using table storage is something that you'd never do in SQL Server, and that's called denormalization, right? Where you copy data to all over the place so that it can be retrieved in a whole bunch of different ways. Now, that might mean that you have each piece of data 15 different places, in 15 different tables. You know, how do you keep that up to date? In an efficient way, in an asynchronous way. Often, a queued update is a way to go. So you update the master record, flick it into a queue that it needs to be propagated, pulls out the other end of the queue, a bunch of workers pick it up, propagate that denormalization, and then everyone's happy. And I'm using this at the moment for audit logging as well in a very large educational application down in Victoria. And it works very, very well because the actual audit writing is writing four or five records for every single audit record that comes in. So you'd never do that in real time. Also used for things like image processing. You know, we might save some raw data over here, put the thing on a queue, go off and process that later on. The model is obviously fairly obvious. Like I said, the performance is not fantastic. So you need to be making sure that you're picking the size of these operations fairly well that fit with the way that the Azure queues perform. Application. Another architectural pattern, another one that's obvious. Now, there's a couple of different ways you can do output caching, but you can cache data at the presentation tier. Usually that's where output caching is done, so caching whole web pages or fragments of web pages. If you start playing around with it, you'll notice that in the Azure environment, there's actually a standard component that will stick your output cache into the Azure cache. So you don't have to do any work to make that happen. You just configure it upright, and your output caches go into there. As always with caching, though, you've got to be careful, stale data. So test it and think about it. How valuable is that? My company built the, I don't know if any of you guys from Victoria, the Superfooty website, which uses the Akamai CDN, because that's what the Herald Sun used for all their stuff. And we had an Azure backend. So in this case, edge caching, like use of a CDN, reduced the load on those servers by over 90%. Okay? Admittedly, we're talking about a very read-heavy environment, okay, with people pulling up footy scores and this sort of jazz, right? But you know, that's a significant thing. You know, 90%, you know, let's have 1/10 as many servers as we had before. That's gonna save you some money, right? And save you from having to administer these things. And then output caching on those central servers reduced the load on the business data tier by about 50% as well. If we hadn't had the CDN, then that number would have been bigger, obviously. Okay, so you start to get into a bit of a diminishing returns thing here. So, but it's real, and it's a good way of doing things. So, getting to the close to the end of the presentation, getting on for time, I believe, we have enough time for questions by the sound of it. So, choosing the right solution for you, okay, it's about what is your application, what are you actually building? It's about the sort of people you have available to you. You might have like the most top gun developers in the world, in which case a more complicated architectural solution will work for you. But you might have, fairly run-of-the-mill developers. Not everybody is the first violinist in the orchestra. So you need to design, or the architect of the system needs to design it with that in mind. And it's also got to be proportional to the scale of the application. Read a record out of the database versus something like Facebook. And you need to consider how complex your data is. If you've got some horrendously complicated data model that needs to be kept perfectly up to date, you may only have SQL as your option. It might be the only way you can go. In which case, again, I mean, you need to look at ways to accelerate that. I've got a few examples here of applications that I've built and the way I usually sort of expect to see them. Line of business applications. Now, that's my company builds a lot of these, like a ERP system for a small company or a provisioning system or something like this, little things. Typically, transactional integrity is very, very, very important. Small numbers of users, right? This is my scenario here. Small numbers of users, most run-of-the-mill developers, so you're probably going to be talking people who are experienced with SQL Server because it's what people have been using for the last 25 years. Quite often you're building hybrid applications as well. So you've got small parts of the system at the customer site with an extension to the cloud. Okay. Now there's a very good session, spruiking someone else's session again. There's a good presentation on hybrid applications. I can't remember who's doing it. I will put up the information at the end of the talk on Thursday at 5:00. That you should probably go to if you are working for an organization that's looking to project your existing servers up into the cloud, well worth attending. So in this case, I would probably be picking something like SQL Azure with Azure caching for acceleration. And that's it. Keep it as simple as possible. And I wouldn't be trying to go too enthusiastic with the way that the Azure cache was used. I'd keep it as architecturally simple as possible. The reason for that being, once again, keeping down the cost. Okay, if by scaling and spending, rather than spending $10 a month, I can spend $50 a month on my SQL Server, and that saves me 1 day of development time, or developer's time, I'm ahead for the year. Remember that, right? Developer's time is very expensive. So don't, when you can scale, do that rather than getting, spending developer time, not delivering business function, consultants, what they like. Internet scale applications, right? Like that Superfooty website. So often, every time you're writing something, you're reading it thousands and thousands of times. There's no transactions. You write some data, or if you get the wrong version now, or with a new version, they're not going to notice, right? They're not going to notice that one score on that match was updated. And then goes back. They're not going to notice that either. Typically, the data can be spread out a lot. For example, if you're talking about something like Facebook, you could partition your data by user, right? So that for every single user, you had a different partition of the data. And then suddenly, you've load leveled. And so unless you've got a user that's incredibly insane and posts everything and everybody in the world reads them, you've still got that sorted out. And the data models are often very simple with these internet scale applications as well. I mean, not as simple as, say, Twitter, 140 byte records or whatever they are, but, more simple than a typical line of business application. So in that case, you'd probably be looking at something like table storage, right? Because it's you don't have to worry about scaling quite so much. The simple data model doesn't matter. And you'd use Felix sensor denormalization if you had to. By that, for example, in the case of Twitter, that could be as much as for every single tweet that somebody puts out, it may well be written to the table for every single follower, right? So if you've got 2 million followers, you write one tweet and you write it to 2 million different records. And that works. And storage is cheap, right? So it's a cheap way of making things go quickly. And then you might use, you know, Hadoop for data analysis. And once again, you know, stick your cache in front of it if it's big. So, conclusion. And then we'll go into Q&A if we've got any time, which we do. There's no single answer to picking a storage option, right? There is a range of them. You need to think about it, unfortunately. You need to consider, if it's important, you need to consider all the options. And, you know, if it's not important, maybe you can take a punt. If you're building a small system, a small site, and you really, really want to use table storage because you never used it before, you know, probably go ahead. You're not going to, there's no wrong answer either, particularly for smaller stuff. And, you know, you can use more than one storage type. Questions? I think you were first. Azure is awesome. Hello, we're at a Microsoft conference. Look, all of these platforms have got their positives and their negatives, right? I actually really like, I have liked from the very, very beginning, the way Azure does its thing. The whole platform as a service concept, for me as a developer and as an architect, was awesome. You know, I didn't have to worry. It gave me what I needed and no more, right? Because you get something like Salesforce, for example, where they give you, you're programming basically applications and you can't do anything about the storage side of things, or you get, you know, something like, Amazon where, or EC2, for example, where they're not giving you anything. So you've got, you need to balance it up. And also, what's the best fit for your organization as well. But because of the Microsoft conference, Azure, awesome. Well, yes. I mean, look, the more partitions you have for table storage, obviously the better the write performance and the read performance is going to be. Some of those performance dips and troughs may actually have been artifacts of the fact that I was hitting it hard, right? So there could have been, like the delay might have been at moving the data onto a different server, hotspots. I was also writing quite a bit of data, so it might have been spreading the partition out over multiple things. There are things that it does, right, to load level. So it's more about the, you know, the fitted line probably. It's not like that particular load, it's going to be like that. You're not always going to be, like I said, it was a not very realistic load. It was to push that thing as hard as possible. So test your own workloads. Gentlemen here. Okay, so the question was around BI, and so were you talking about using cloud-based BI for? Are you talking about BI on site for data that you have in the cloud? Yeah, well, I mean, one option is Hadoop, definitely. Like, if you've got so much data that you can't, you know, sync down the deltas in overnight without costing you a fortune, it might be time to look at one of those sort of big data solutions, or you know, implement it up in the cloud. There are BI options. There are BI products that are built on top of Azure. I haven't got any data on them here, but you know, if you want to drop me a line, I can probably help you try and track some of them down eventually. Come grab a business card when you're finished. Yeah. Anyone else? All right, well, session evaluation, you can win a mouse. Pretty cool looking thing. All these sessions are going to be on Channel 9. And tweet, and you can win a helicopter ride. Wouldn't that be awesome? So thank you very much for coming. I'll just run over this for a second. Okay, these are some other sessions you might be interested in, right? DBI 225, Big Data for Relational Practitioners. That's tomorrow afternoon. That should be quite useful for, well, for example, for you, if you want to look at BI solutions, and anyone who's interested in Hadoop, that's what that one's going to be about. Chris Padgett's running a nice session tomorrow afternoon as well, building hybrid solutions. So if you're, you know, work for some sort of company and you're trying to project your servers up into the cloud, that will give you a, you know, a more detailed analysis of the ways you can do that. It's not just about storage, so that's why I didn't cover it directly here. If you are trying to build a decent-sized SQL implementation in the cloud that you need to make work, Peter Ward's presentation would be very useful, I think. You know, how to design your SQL Server implementation so it actually does work when you try to hit it scaled. And as I said before, Wade Wegner's presentation on Friday. Unfortunately, they're both on at the same time. Bad planning from someone's point of view, I reckon. But anyway, Wade Wegner's presentation on planning for failure. So if you're a developer or an architect and you want to sort of look at the best options for handling these sort of problems, there's your session. All right. Thank you very much. I'll be in the speaker lounge if everyone wants to have a chat for the next hour or so, and then I think we're going to go and pass out. Thank you.